thanks for coming out on a nice Tuesday afternoon to talk about real estate speculations. This is part of a book project that I've been working on for a couple of years, and I'm very happy to have a Great Cities faculty scholarship this year, in addition to some of my administrative duties here, to work on this project a little more. So if you looked out of my window, I'm very happy to have a window in this office. I've had 13 years without. If you looked out of my window, which is across the hallway, and is focused on the West Loop, and you had sort of set up a camera there in, let's say, November 16th, 1998. And for 10 years after that, sort of took kind of time-lapse photography every few months, you would see the skyline changing pretty dramatically. So between 1998 and around 2008, we witnessed a lot of new construction, major rehabilitation in the city of Chicago. You would have seen parking lots replaced by green glass blocks like the ABN AMRO building, which is the first building over here, or the UBS Tower, which was the first multi-tenant tower to be constructed in Chicago for 6 years in 1999. So 6 years in between that, there were really no major buildings built in the loop. But between 1998 and around 2008, there was a lot of activity. We've counted, my research assistant Ian Ludwig and I, 140 sort of major large-scale commercial projects. And these include retail projects, office, multifamily tenant, residential buildings. And observers of this kind of, you know, sort of massive activity, what Rem Koolhaas called delirious or discontinuous speed-ups, We call booms, construction booms. And Chicago was certainly not the only city that experienced one during this time. So did Atlanta, Dallas, Washington, D.C., cities in Europe like Madrid and London, every city in China. This is a slide that just shows change in the 10 largest office markets during this period. You can see Chicago, the change in rentable building area, which is what RBA stands for, is about 14% higher than sort of what it started in 1998. So during booms, we witnessed major transformations and modernization of the urban fabric. And however disorienting, they tend to be celebrated as moving us toward the future, clearing the path through creative destruction of the existing built environment. But they're also a disjuncture, or they also remind us of the disjuncture between what we call use values and exchange values, between the value of property in terms of its sort of social utility, how users or tenants in this case in commercial buildings actually use the building, and their value in exchange. As the real estate industry often gets ahead of occupant needs and market fundamentals. So booms often result in overbuilding, rapid appreciation, and involuntary dislocations, defaults into closures, and what we call an overhang of vacant and underutilized space when all the dust clears. Because real estate markets are so thoroughly integrated with the rest of the economy, booms now have the capacity to bring other markets, such as labor markets and credit markets, to their knees. So as I said, I'm working on a book this year that's taking a look, it's sort of an autopsy of the last commercial construction boom, not just in the city of Chicago, but more generally in the United States. And I'm trying to use economic sociology, tools from economic sociology to kind of to write a political economy of the last boom, if that makes any sense. My focus is on the routine professional practices of real estate actors, individuals in the world of finance and local governments that I will argue encourage speculative investment and create incentives for new construction as opposed to the rehabilitation of older structures. They also create incentives for fast-paced capital mobility and periodic overbuilding. When reinforced by low-cost financing and the presence of over-eager buyers, as they are during boom times, these practices tend to lead to new construction that is detached from real market demand and performance. And they also, even though I'm not going to have too much time to talk about this in this presentation, hasten the pace at which older buildings and entire neighborhoods are vacated and junked. So I focus on three interrelated fields or sets of professional practices. The first are incentives within the sort of financial markets or sort of the financial professions to create liquidity, to move money around global capital markets and contribute to new investment vehicles, such as buildings and the securities that are based on the debt and income streams of these buildings. Second, I focus on the practice of real estate brokers, investment advisors, and appraisers who help to fashion space needs and thereby serve as gatekeepers to value in the built environment. Their compensation depends on their ability to boost transaction activity and shuffle tenants around, typically from marginally older buildings into the new space that is constructed during this time. And third, I focus on the policies of city governments that encourage overbuilding and provide financial and regulatory incentives to remove the detritus left over from these frenzied waves of building and discarding. So what I've done, just sort of quickly methodologically, is I've been conducting interviews for the last several years, interviewing practitioners, as I said, mostly in Chicago, but who operate sort of nationally and globally, who are active in the real estate industry. So, calling this elite ethnography, attending also lots of meetings that are of professionals also in this field, and analyzing various kinds of financial and real estate trend data. I just want to talk a little bit about my sort of theoretical framework before I jump into some of the empirics. In the work, I am returning to some very familiar and fundamental questions in urban studies, like why do cities change and why do new buildings get built? The dominant explanations... Our dominant explanation for urban change can be found in economics, which tends to privilege the demand side, so the needs of occupiers, and draws very heavily from neoclassical rent theory. So new buildings are built because there's demand for new or different kinds of space. So it's based on the utility that's derived from the use of the space. And if this is true, if this sort of framework sort of plays out in practice, then we should see spatial change closely aligning with or mimicking trends in population and office employment or commercial employment. Rent theory predicts that developers will respond to rising rents by producing more until the new space is absorbed and the market is pulled back to equilibrium. Economists tend to explain booms as, you know, based on the sort of underlying economic expansion. And when there is an overhang or if there's overbuilding or kind of a lack of synchronization between the demand and supply side, then it's due to some kind of distorting effect like the long-term nature of leases or the time involved in getting buildings permitted or tax policy. On the other side, we see more heterodox approaches. Scholars in the critical urban political economy or new urban sociology type of framework, both of which were sort of developed in the 1970s, who argue that urban change is a reflection more of structural factors that affect the supply of space. So things like the temporal and spatial logics of capitalist urbanization, property relations, financial investment circuits, regulatory changes, and political coalitions that steer and accommodate these market changes. So it's the exchange value, the value of property in exchange that's realized by investors that trump the utility enjoyed by the consumers of space. And so these are the real drivers of urban change. So for them, booms and busts are not aberrations, but something quite natural, as capitalism is subject to reoccurring and perpetual accumulation crises. So I've worked within both of these frameworks, in the urban economics framework and the sort of critical urban political economy framework, for several years, and I've got some sort of bones to pick with both of them. Neither takes history particularly seriously or differentiates between the different kinds of construction or different construction cycles that have occurred throughout different points in history. The investment and tenant markets may become periodically decoupled because of supply or demand factors that assert themselves with different intensities over time. So it's not the same factors that account for booms throughout history. For example, the post-war boom was quite different than the one in the 1980s, which was very different from this last, what I'm calling the millennial boom. Moreover, with a few exceptions, both of these perspectives tend to ignore the actual agents, the actors and institutions that are involved in the development process. So economists who hold to rational expectations assume that real estate developers and tenants are just responding to price signals, ignoring the institutions and behaviors that mediate between demand and supply. And similarly, in the critical urban political economy or geography literatures, capital is characterized as perpetually dynamic and naturally expansionary, but the actors and institutions that make this happen remain abstract and unexamined. So in contrast to these kinds of accounts, and I recognize that I'm stereotyping both to make a point, I take a more sort of sociological approach to understanding the rhythms of urban development. Capital invested in the built environment is not innately restless and does not move according to its own internal logic and schedule. Instead, its movement must be facilitated and directed, a role that falls not just to individuals, but to individuals socialized within particular professions. So that's where my focus is really on sort of professions, these sort of critical communities that mediate between structure and agency. Professional actors don't just act on their own, but instead rely on regularized routines, different kinds of accepted calculations, techniques, and standards that are pretty consistent across their membership. They make arguments for capital's free movement, and they do so within specific temporal and geographic and political contexts. So I'm drawing more here in my work on in this particular book, I'm drawing pretty heavily on sort of sociological accounts of professional development. So people like the work of Bruno Latour, Andrew Abbott, Pierre Bourdieu. And I demonstrate how critical actors in the real estate industry produce the conditions needed for speculation and capital circulation. So they provide the sort of the market intermediation that allows for capital to release itself from pre-existing commitments and to move on to potentially more profitable arrangements. So what's the relationship between professional practices and speculation? I argue that professional rules and routines act as a kind of talisman, giving actors in these fields the sense of normalcy and security that they need to gamble on the future, which is what they're doing when they're constructing buildings with no or few tenants, acquiring half-empty buildings, purchasing bundled mortgages as security, even though there are questions about how those mortgages are going to be paid, making equity investments in projects in less tested markets, all sort of behavior that's common during construction booms. So customary techniques and procedures that have been vetted by the collective, by the profession, make this kind of decision-making under uncertainty seem sensible and rational, reducing the appearance of risk and affording actors the sort of confidence or optimism to speculate. So they comprise what Keynes called a practical theory of the future, which along with what he called animal spirits, like whim, sentiment, and hysteria, tend to justify these decisions. The pace at which decisions must be made, the sort of urgency to transact, the speed to market, make actors gravitate toward those signs that rely on collective judgments, the judgments of others, because they are possibly better informed than just than individual ones. And the more people or the more professions sort of playing the game, the stronger it gets. Real estate is built by teams of varied professions who work together and through repeated interactions share norms in ways that create network effects and adaptive expectations. As long as the money keeps flowing, the deals get done, these actions are validated and reproduced. So what kinds of techniques and professional routines am I talking about? In this project, I pay particular attention to issues of valuation and appraisal, so how do we determine the value of buildings, and particularly the association that valuation has with the age of the building. So again, I'm interested in sort of the, why the sort of emphasis on sort of newer, more modern structures, and then what sort of leads to the elimination of older building stock. So I look at constructs like the construct of obsolescence, which gets sort of flung around and used a lot by these different professions, as well as the different kinds of appraisal and valuation methodologies and the tax treatment of real estate. And this idea that these sort of professional norms would encourage speculation and overbuilding directly contradicts a lot of the work in the field, particularly those that rely on a kind of Durkheimian notion of professions, which has a decidedly normative and positive overtone. So the conventional wisdom among organizations like the World Bank, for example, is that there is an inverse relationship between professions and speculative bubbles. So they point to things like the dearth of appraisers and actuaries and analysts in Thailand and Malaysia in the 1990s to show that sort of the absence of sort of real professional knowledge is what sort of led to these kinds of risks that are involved in property transactions and overbuilding. In some of the research that's currently being disseminated, they found that countries that have a greater share of financial professions have the ability to dampen and quickly respond to speculative booms, that they are less likely to invest in risky assets like commercial real estate and have more functioning, complete capital markets. By showing how easily professional routines were able to accommodate these huge infusions of cash and encourage speculation in the last boom, however, I'm obviously taking issue with this line of argumentation. So let's take a look at Chicago. A little bit of context. I mean, think you can tell from this. This is a slide of deliveries of new office buildings in Chicago from 1800. There weren't any office buildings in 1800. It's just kind of a swampy savanna. Between 1800 and 2010. And you can kind of see that there are some pretty distinct cycles of building. In this case, we're just looking at that office construction. But this last little boomlet over here, 2000 to 2010, you can see is probably only half as big as the one that preceded it. So in Chicago, this, even though this last boom may seem like it was pretty transformative, it really in some ways doesn't hold a candle to the last boom, which was during the sort of late 1970s and 1980s, where very much sort of exceeded the amount of sort of new commercial stock that was built. During the millennial boom, 1998 through 2008, the Chicago office market added more than 50 million square feet of rentable building area, or about 14% over the stock that existed in 1998. And about 60% of that, so that's for the whole region, about 50 million, 60% of that was in the Loop, which is our largest office market. More than 45 buildings were built that were over 50 stories tall. About 15% of that new construction was Class A office space. There were some hotels and some retail, but the bulk of the new construction that took place over the last boom was large-scale multifamily residential buildings, in looking at the Central Business District of Chicago. Where did this building take place? Again, I'm going to thank Ian for this map. The diamonds are new construction, large-scale projects, commercial projects that were built during this period. The darker it gets is the more recent took place. And you can see that it's really, you know, this is south of the river and to the east of the river, sort of the traditional Loop, or the sort of traditional boundaries or borders of the Loop. A lot of the new development took place, and it was sort of expanding the Loop both westward and northward. So the West Loop was consistently posting vacancy rates that were 2% lower than the rest of the Loop, and rental rates that were about $2 per square foot higher than the rest of the Loop, thanks to sort of, you know, proximity to the commuter rail stations, the Ogilvie train station that was rehabbed by the city, and then also sort of the river north, the area north of the river, also represents a sort of expansion of the Loop beyond its traditional borders. Who developed this new construction? The office market tended to be dominated by a handful of locally headquartered developers, with the exception of Houston-based Hines and Trammell Crow, which is out of Dallas. Companies like Fifield, John Buck, the Alter Group, Joseph Fried, they led the way, constructing 2 to 4 new towers each. In what sense was this speculative development? As with most booms, some of the earlier buildings were commissioned. Buildings commissioned by large corporate headquarters or large corporations that were operating in the Loop. And the banks imposed pretty strict pre-leasing requirements. So you had to fill a certain portion of the building before you got the financing. But as the boom wore on, those standards became more lax. So they're speculative in a sense that the buildings were able to get built having few tenants in them or even no tenants in them and no sort of pre-leasing commitments. They're also speculative in a sense that the owners / developers / investors did not intend to hold on to them for too long, but expected to flip them at higher prices shortly after construction. And that's what happened in pretty much most of these cases. These buildings are pretty expensive to build, and the investors bet on future appreciation, refinancing and financial engineering, things like securitizing the mortgages to be able to increase the size of the yields. So what was motivating this last boom? What was behind it? It's hard to tell, because in the middle of construction frenzies, it's often difficult to sort of slow down enough to single out the factors that are really driving it. The demand and the supply side catalysts tend to blur into one another as the growth machine cylinders are firing all, at 100% and in the same general direction. So you've got building permits that are granted, you've got corporate management considering expansion plans, there are loans that are being made, zoning is altered, equity is raised, brokers are signing on new tenants, valuations are peaking, new competitors are entering the market. It's hard to sort of disentangle all these things, all these sort of different events and behaviors that are taking place during booms to sort of see sort of who's driving whom. But most observers tend to agree that the boom, and this is not just in the city of Chicago, but in other, this last boom, not just in the city of Chicago, but in other major U.S. cities as well, was not being driven by much new demand. The Loop had been home to corporate headquarters, professional services firms like legal and accounting, and many government offices. And there were a few major new firms that moved to the city of Chicago in the late 1990s, early 2000s, the most high profile of which being the headquarters of Boeing. But these cases were actually more the exception than the norm. In fact, for every high-profile firm relocating from outside the region to Chicago, an existing business moved away or was purchased or downsized after a merger or acquisition, often leaving a lot of extra square footage, space, contributing that to what it was already sort of becoming the swollen Loop market with relatively high vacancies. It's also clear that new businesses weren't necessarily moving to the Chicago region, so these new buildings weren't being built for them. Employment trends tended to be pretty flat. Employment growth in Chicago's Central Business District slowed to an average of 0.5% during these years, so between 1998 and 2008, compared to the 4% annualized growth rates that occurred in the late 1970s and 1980s. So you can see just the pink line is all industry employment in the Chicago CBD. And by 2008, you're sort of approaching what it was like before the boom. So there was some people actually refer to this last boom as two separate boomlets, the boom before 2001 and the boom sort of after the recovery of 2001. The key factor to note is that the boom seemed to be built on the back of existing as opposed to new demand. So the majority of space seekers in the Loop, in the Central Business District, were existing businesses that were already in the Chicago region and in many cases were already in the Loop. A couple years ago, some colleagues and I conducted a small empirical study of businesses in the Chicago region, using the Dun & Bradstreet data. And we were able to sort of track where they were moving. Anytime there was a move, we could find out what building they were leaving and what new building they occupied as well, and that therefore what zip code they were leaving and what zip code they were occupying. And we developed some maps. This is one of them. This is, again, sort of an earlier study, so it ends in 2003. But the area in red are those zip codes that were sort of net losers, meaning more businesses moved out than moved in. And the areas in blue were those that were net receivers. They received more businesses than left. And so you can see the sort of area, the area that is really known as, the Loop is pretty red. The darker the red or the darker the blue is sort of the more of a net winner or loser you were. So we found that businesses tend to be making very small relocations, or they're moving very short distances. So they were, the majority of movers were moving within the Loop. And they were moving to points west and north for the most part. Or even staying within their own sometimes 9-digit zip code. So they were moving sometimes, next door to a building, or sometimes moving within the same building. And we also conducted interviews with several commercial real estate brokers and found that when these establishments move, they do tend to circulate through different parts of the same sort of office submarket. And there's a quote here at the bottom from a vice president at the Alter Group, and I thought it was very telling, that there's very little fresh meat, right? So a little descriptive, that the businesses that were moving into the new office buildings that were being built weren't necessarily from outside, but there was sort of a shuffling around of existing businesses that were already in the CBD. What kinds of businesses? Primarily law firms. Law firms and financial firms. These were the sort of big relocations that took place during this time period, moving from slightly older buildings to newer buildings. So just north of the Sears Tower is the Pritzker Center, the Hyatt Center built by the Pritzkers, 47 47-story building where the law firm Mayor Brown moved to from a building on LaSalle Street. Nearby, John Buck developed a building, the 111 South Wacker, a 51-story building that became the new home to Deloitte and Touche, and the law firm Lord Bissell & Brooks. So pretty much every major law firm in the city of Chicago relocated during the boom, and a lot of these new buildings that were being built became the sort of new homes of those businesses. Now, what does this all have to do with professions and professional practices? I'm arguing that particularly when there isn't much sort of natural growth, so there's no pressure from new firms or no new employees to consume space, that demand for space has to be made. It has to be constructed. It has to be configured and fashioned. And who does this but professions? So in one of my book chapters, I look at these large commercial brokerages who represented either the owners who are looking to lease up their buildings or the space users, the tenants themselves. The main job of the broker was to shuffle tenants around during this period, a job that was made easier by the addition of this nice new stock that was constructed during the boom. So there's a lot of mobility and movement taking place during this time. The number of leases that were signed per year more than doubled. So the annual number of leases signed doubled between 1997 and 2007. What brokers were doing was validating the existence of these new buildings by making the market. They asserted that the developers, they would assert to developers, who would then assert to their financiers, that they could lease up that building due to their access to heavily guarded information. They knew who, you know, so-and-so's lease was expiring, so-and-so's looking for a different kind of space, so-and-so wants a better address. So real estate brokers, I found, achieve a kind of status and group membership within their profession through their ability to know this kind of insider information and then to use it to close the deal and to relocate clients. The constitutive discourse of this field relies heavily, I found, on sports metaphors. Several of the largest commercial brokerages, like the Staubach companies, name ring a bell, and Draper and Kramer were headed by former college sports legends. So I found my lack of knowledge of sports to be a real detriment to actually conducting this project. Brokers and tenant reps also have material incentives. So it's not just sort of the symbolic capital of moving clients around. So they also have material incentives to sort of encourage this kind of mobility, and particularly moving clients from existing older space to newly constructed space because of the way they derive their compensation through commissions, bonuses, and leasing fees. They make the most money, so these were considered the sort of most important deals when they were able to represent the owners of these gleaming new office towers. So in the hierarchy of this very sort of hierarchized profession, filling these new office towers was commanded the greatest respect. That was considered a slam dunk in this world. Moreover, brokers instilled in themselves and in their clients certain social conventions that indirectly spurred additional new construction and created vacancies in older existing buildings. For example, when one major law firm or financial services firm decamped to a new building, brokers encouraged the rest of their flocks to follow suit. So, they say, so-and-so law firm moved to this building, you should consider making a move as well. But I found that competing businesses within the same industry often refused, for reasons of pride and repute, to occupy space that had been vacated by a competitor, as such a move was perceived as an admission of their own lower rank. So even though Mayor Brown would vacate, 10 floors on LaSalle Street, another law firm of sort of what they considered to be the same status wouldn't move in there. They needed to build their own building. So cheap credit building concessions. So the owners of these buildings, realizing that there really wasn't much new market, having to create this market, offered things like concessions. So very generous tenant improvement budgets to try to attract tenants. And this also encouraged overreaching. The ability of brokers to be convincing rested on their expertise to match client needs to space. They spoke with authority about the topic of obsolescence, which achieved a kind of technical legitimacy through the use of valuations and other criteria, which distinguished between sort of the more modern, desirable products, while also denigrating sort of older existing buildings. I found that the work of brokers was validated by the public sector. So during this time, Chicago, the city of Chicago, at the height of the boom, when private capital was very easy to come by, often used TIF, or tax increment financing, to provide relocation assistance to several existing businesses in the loop, including some very high-profile cases of relocating some corporate headquarters. These were justified as necessary to prevent these firms from moving out of the city. And so planners approved allocations ranging from $1 million to about $30 million to assist in the relocation of these corporations from one loop building to another. The allocations typically took the form of an allowance for moving expenses and tenant build-outs of the new space. And, of course, these actions tended to move businesses from older buildings to newer ones. So U.S. Gypsum, which is here, moved from 125 South Franklin to a new building at 550 West Adams. Quaker Oats relocated from 321 North Clark to 555 West Monroe, and so on and so forth. Most of these were moved from existing older buildings to newer ones. So as I'm, you know, these are also sort of routine practices, the practices of economic development, which many of us in the room study, which sort of makes itself an accomplice to this process of speculative building. So incentives to build new have become very deeply embedded in real estate professions. But unless the money is there, they can't really act on them, right? Cities remain rather brittle, obdurate artifacts with little change and little movement. So during this last boom, the easy availability of credit, cheap credit, and equity encouraged real estate actors to move forward with ambitious projects, even in the absence of actual market demand. Money was coming from the importing foreign trade surpluses, mainly from Asia and from Europe, sovereign wealth funds, institutional investors who were turned off by the low interest rates of treasuries and sort of the continued free fall of profit rates in the primary productive sector of the economy. But capital, as I'm arguing, doesn't just find its way to the construction and acquisition of urban real estate on its own. It's intermediated by actors with their own interests, sort of shared meanings, ways, reasons for doing things, professions or institutions like investment funds, life insurance companies, pension funds, and other conduit lenders who originated, bought, and sold commercial-backed CMBSs or commercially backed securities and higher risk collateralized debt obligations. So these are essentially pooled and repackaged commercial mortgages, which are sold in public capital markets. So in Chicago, we have divisions of Morgan Stanley, Wachovia, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, all quite active as intermediaries, packaging loans and selling them or holding on to securities in their own portfolios. Whereas less than 2% of commercial mortgages were securitized in 1990, 26% were by the end of 2007. And Chicago is known as a strong market for CMBS loans and was considered one of the top six cities for institutional investors, the others being New York, Boston, San Francisco, D.C., and Los Angeles. So pricing in these markets was meaningfully higher than in the next tier. And as a result, there was a lot of money competing to make construction loans and mortgages to acquire to buildings in this period, and interest rates declined, obviously, which made capital quite cheap, accessible, and easy to access. Securitization left conventional non-securitizing lenders in the dust, so many of the smaller regional banks, particularly those that were shut out of the CMBS market, sort of barreled their way into real estate lending. The proportion of regional bank lending that was in commercial real estate nearly doubled during this period. I found that securitization standards and underwriting criteria both reflected a bias toward new construction. Higher rents, lower expense ratios made the numbers look especially good. Developers could access debt based on future rents rather than existing income and on future values that were inflated by very, very low cap rates, which are the ratio between income and sales price, so low that they'd actually fallen to their lowest point in history. Many of these developers and owners became dangerously over-leveraged, but were not concerned as the prices continued to rise. Chicago experienced pretty rapid appreciation, particularly between 2005 and 2007, and refinancing was always a possibility. So these prices were fueled by one of the most active acquisitions markets in Chicago's in Chicago's history as potential buyers lined up to buy under-leased new office towers. The largest private equity deal in history, which was Sam Zell's sale of equity office property, his REIT, to the Blackstone Group, where he sold 573 properties, had a big effect on the Chicago market. So buildings like the Civic Opera House, 10 Wacker Drive, 30 Wacker Drive, these were all buildings that were owned by this REIT and sold. So knowing that they could walk away from projects that were not particularly successful because of the high amounts of debt and the presence of buyers that were willing to take them out of their hands, sort of kept the construction cycle and the acquisition cycle moving. So here's the a slide just of the, in terms of the volume of sales. So the amount of sales, you can see that 2006 and 2007. 2007 is when Equity Office was sold to Blackstone, were sort of watermarks for, or is that the expression, for acquisition activity in Chicago. So when I interviewed suppliers of capital, I interviewed lenders or advisors to pension funds, I found that while they described the sort of crazy pace and extraordinary times of the boom, in retrospect, it was also clear that they stuck to certain sort of known routines and a faith in particular abstractions to get them through. To move their money, for example, banks, as we know, got aggressive with things like non-recourse debt or lower debt coverage ratios, underwriting standards, but they justified such actions by pointing to the sky-high appraisals that they were receiving and the positive market analyses that they were conducting. In other words, they endowed these estimates of value with a kind of social efficacy, making them responsible for subsequent actions. These high values then sent distorted signals back to lenders who then increased credit supply. To avoid the feeling of sort of going at it or speculating alone, they pointed to other professional standards and tried to anticipate or second-guess the interests of those actors who are now becoming implicated in increasingly complex financial transactions. For example, they argued that new buildings and vacant land were just more valuable to global investors who favored certain standards of new construction, who favored certain architects and maximum leasable floor area. So as the chain of ownership became more attenuated and fragmented, the sort of pressures for legibility rose, and the sort of less valuable, older, existing, idiosyncratic buildings became. If the assets were, you know, if they required sort of local knowledge to understand, if there was historic preservation issues, you know, or if they didn't sort of meet the sort of template or the profile of what global investors were looking for, they were considered to be less liquid, more risky, and more difficult to unload. So in other words, real estate, if real estate is capable of becoming a more liquid financial asset that is abstracted from local conditions, then its physical form must also become more abstract. I had one interesting interview with a banker who was saying that, you know, his bank, and they were a Canadian bank, wouldn't touch the Empire State Building with a 10-foot pole. And sort of other sort of, you know, very, again, you know, sort of high-profile historic buildings in the city of Chicago, that the floor plates are just too small, or that, it, you know, just they would not be able to unload or sell a project like that. It's very beautiful, but it's, you know, its value is pretty diminished in their eyes. And once again, we saw the local state playing a supporting role in this sort of acquisition and construction frenzy. The public sector helped to inflate property values and encourage new construction using its power of investment, public investment in infrastructure, deregulation of things like zoning and subsidy to reinvigorate the loop. The city of Chicago acquired parcels of land on the perimeter, sold them below market rate to private developers, invested in infrastructure like extending the Well Street into Chinatown, and redeveloped the West Loop commuter train station using TIF. Also, the domino effect of relocations, moves, and vacancies created pressure on the city to step in at the bottom of the food chain. So, as I haven't really gotten a chance to talk about, not all buildings necessarily do well in booms, and it's the older ones that are particularly vulnerable. It was left to the city to smooth out some of the temporal inconsistencies, demolish these older buildings, kick out some non-conforming uses, and in general sort of reduce the supply of older building stock. Dampening the supply eliminates some of the competition and bolsters the property values of the new building. And this is what the city sort of used TIF for in some ways, sort of a different form of remediation. you know, so the city has to, in order to designate a TIF district, the city has to demonstrate that the area is obsolete, or the buildings in the area is they're obsolete, the area is blighted. And it did so in places like the LaSalle Street or the LaSalle Central Redevelopment Corridor, where it used TIF money to convert Class B and C office space into hotels and condominiums. The city also was able to use some TIF assistance to tear down some buildings, even though, again, in this boom, there weren't as many demolitions as there were in previous ones. Some came down. Things like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange came down for a hotel, a portion of the building. The Hotel LaSalle's parking garage, which was the city's first multi-story parking garage, came down in 2005, part of the 700 block of North Michigan Avenue, 174 West Randolph. Many of these buildings were demolished with TIF assistance. So I'm going to sum up. At the risk of anthropomorphizing buildings, I started off with their birth. I talked about new construction and sort of ended with the expiration of their life on Earth and talking about the demolition of buildings that took place during this last boom. What I've tried to do is show how real estate actors regularly produce understandings of buildings that privilege new construction while stigmatizing marginally older structures as obsolete. They're kicked into action with a surfeit of money and a queue of overeager buyers. These routine practices create buildings that are often detached from real market demand and performance, but also have the effect of sort of hastening the pace at which older buildings and entire neighborhoods, in some cases, are vacated. This undergirds what has come to be known as creative destruction, which, as I hope I've convinced you, is just as much a socially constructed process as it is an anarchistic economic necessity. So, thank you.